Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about why a plant-based diet is the best thing one can do for one's health and for the environment.
So if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about the environment, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we'll have a conversation about animal rights with Dr. James Brousseau, professor of philosophy at Pace University in New York. But first, some news.
From One Green Planet, at times we find ourselves absolutely appalled at the extent human beings will go for the sake of profit at the expense of animals. There's a new culinary trend popping up in restaurants around California and New York that has us picking our jaws up off the floor, the consumption of live animals. Some people justify boiling lobsters alive because they claim lobsters and other shellfish do not feel pain, which is pretty ridiculous in and of itself. But it gets worse. A new trend where octopus, lobsters, and shrimp are being pinned down, cut open, and eaten alive at these restaurants is coming to the forefront of the food world. According to a petition on Care2, at restaurants across the country, octopuses, after suffering a harrowing shipment halfway around the world, are hacked apart and served as a Korean dish, which translates literally to wriggling octopus. Over a dozen restaurants in California and New York mutilate and serve live octopuses and other animals like shrimp and lobster. If you are as shocked and disgusted by this practice of eating live animals, please take a minute out of your day to sign a petition at onegreenplanet.org, urging lawmakers to put a stop to this atrocity. The fight does not end here, though. Although eating live animals is certainly inhumane, we must remember that all animals on our plates were once living, who were killed for our consumption.
Elmhurst Dairy in Queens, New York, has ceased its dairy operation after 90 years, citing decreased consumer demand. Since it was incorporated in the 1920s, Elmhurst has grown to be one of the largest dairy manufacturers on the East Coast of the United States, supplying an area of 7 million people. CEO Henry Swartz said the company has been operating at a loss in recent years. He said that pasteurized fluid milk has gone out of style. The shutdown reflects ongoing trends in the dairy milk business, increased consumer awareness of the treatment of cows in the milk industry, as well as consumer concern about saturated fat, cholesterol, and hormones, is causing year-on-year declining sales. Milk consumption peaked in the late 1940s and has declined sharply in the last few years, down by half in the last 5 years. But there's been a growth explosion for plant-based milks, so Elmhurst Dairy dropped the word dairy from its name and has been renamed to simply Elmhurst, and will instead produce their own range of healthy, plant-based milks. Their new products are suitable for vegans and have very minimal ingredients. Their new line has up to 4 times more nuts per serving than other leading brands and will be available in 4 varieties, almond, hazelnut, cashew, and walnut. Each contains only raw, cold-milled nuts and simple ingredients. No emulsifiers, thickeners, or whiteners are used. I was a vegetarian for 20 years before I gave up dairy and went vegan 18 years ago because I believed the propaganda from the dairy industry. I thought I needed dairy for calcium. I thought dairy products were a superior form of protein and that they contained some nutrient not available in plants. The fact is, leafy greens contain more bioavailable calcium than milk, and plant sources of protein have all the nutrients, all the amino acids needed by humans. Milk doesn't build strong bones. The nations of the world with the highest rates of dairy consumption have the highest rates of bone fractures. Dairy products have been linked to heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and many other diseases. Dairy farming is more environmentally destructive than beef farming and is a huge waste of natural resources. It takes 1,000 gallons of water to produce 1 quart of milk. Dairy cows suffer tremendously on factory dairy farms. They are more mistreated than any animals we raise for meat. They are forcibly impregnated each year to keep them producing milk. Their babies are taken away from them at birth to become veal. And after 5 years, when their production of milk slows, they are turned into cheap hamburger and pet food. There are all kinds of alternatives to dairy products: non-dairy milks, yogurt and cheese substitutes, vegan ice cream. Kick the dairy habit. Milk does nobody good. Stay with us. Our guest on today's show is James Brousseau. Dr. Brousseau is the author of several books on ethics and philosophy and is a professor of philosophy at Pace University in New York. He specializes in contemporary continental philosophy, the history of philosophy, and ethics. We'll be talking about his new book, Dignity, Pleasures, Vulgarity. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on ACT Radio, Dr. James Brousseau. Thanks for being with us, James.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Hey, James, to start us off, we're curious what attracted you to the idea of animal rights.
Right. Well, it started with a sort of academic project. I was writing a textbook chapter on standard theoretical approaches to animal rights, and I started to become interested in not only how the kinds of theories that we've developed, but also how the understandings that we develop of animal rights can reverberate back and afford insights into human reality. That is, in a certain sense, I became interested in thinking about animal rights not so much as animals, they are a subject of our thought and theory, but instead as sort of creatures that share our experiences to some extent. And I wondered, well, if we can use our own human experiences to think about animals, I wonder if we can also think in a certain extent, or to a certain degree, use animal experiences to think about human ethics and so on. So my entrance into this area of discussion is started out theoretically, but I think it's come around to be much more experiential. That is, what kinds of experiences do we have, do animals have, and how do they relate to each other in terms of ethics and morality? So that's the book. It's an attempt to sort of strip away the academic talk of ethics in animals and take this discussion into this human realm in terms and experiences that we've all had. So that's how I got started, and that's how we ended up with this book that we're discussing today briefly.
You know, in the first section of your book, when you're talking about dignity, you make the argument that a creature has dignity if it has a sense of its own life, of its a sense that it wants to continue its life. And that leads me to think that anything that has legs that can run away from pain, or wings that can fly away, or be able to swim away, that right there demonstrates the fact that that creature has a life of meaning, you know, to itself.
Right. I think that's a terrifically important point, and that's one of the two approaches that we can take to talk about animal rights. One is this notion of dignity, which is somewhat abstract, and then the other is this notion of pleasures. But the question of dignity, then, is very interesting from a historical perspective, because historically, we have demoted animals in terms of ethics and morality, because we've said that they don't have dignity for the following reason. Animals do not demonstrate a high degree of rational cultural development. That is, they don't rationalize or conceptualize their experiences. They don't have ceremonies. They don't have holidays and so on. But you can just as easily say, going the other way, right, well, the dignity is that these things are just accidental behaviors. And dignity is not so much about rationality, but rather it's about understanding and having a sense of yourself. And that's exactly the move that Tom Regan made. It's very interesting also for human beings and for animals to think, well, what does it mean to have fundamental human dignity? Is it rationality, or is it something else? Is it instead a sense of yourself as an identity moving through time? And so Tom Regan in his 1983 book talked about that and made that move. And so you're right, that's the way animal rights have developed along that front. And then it's also, it's curious to think about the human experience too, whether dignity is rationality really the leading edge of human experience, or is it human experience is more about understanding ourselves as identities that continue through time? And I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but it's an interesting question that comes up because we talk about animal rights.
You know, I think in the last decade or two, we've come to understand a little bit more about animal behavior and how they do have rationality and thought processes that we hadn't really considered before. And animal rights activists like Tom and I always make arguments such as the way we treat animals is similar to the way we treated slaves, the way we treated other tribes, women. We always tend to have a hierarchy with us on top.
Right. That's a terrific point. And then I think that you could also go in that direction. You could say, look, instead of redefining dignity for creatures as an existence in time, instead of rationality, we could keep the traditional definition, which is that human dignity is based upon this notion of rationality, and then import some part of the animal realm into that definition. I think that's going to be a little bit more difficult, though, because the number sort of species demonstrate what we consider to be rationality seems to be much more limited when compared with the species that demonstrate a sense of themselves in time.
You know, I'd rather extend the doubt to the fact that any creature has an identity. We're just not able to observe it as well with smaller creatures. You know, I try to capture cockroaches and take them outside because I think perhaps, you know, this guy wants to live. But, you know, besides thought processes and recognizing oneself in the mirror and other tests we've devised to try to measure animal intelligence, I even had an argument about altruism and how animals weren't capable of altruism is what the other person said. But there have been examples of creatures saving other members of other species,
right?
And chimpanzees that refuse to administer electric shocks to their neighbors when they, you know, in order to get food, and all other kinds of altruistic behaviors that we hadn't considered until recently.
Right. A nice way to sort of package, it sounds to me, what you're saying is that if we are going to impose a kind of rationality test on non-human animals, and if we fail to find that rationality in them, perhaps the problem is not that the animals lack rationality. Instead, it's a failure of our own thought understand the rationality that they exhibit. So that would be the way that you could, I think, package very nicely that point that you're making. And I think that there's a field of investigation there, too, which would be very interesting. We would ask, well, what constitutes rationality? If our rationality is so limited that we can't recognize it in others, then it would seem that there's a lot of work to do then to define what rationality is. And that's also an interesting project that kind of comes out of this interaction when we think of human and non-human animals on the same level. We can ask questions and see that in perhaps find different fields of investigation that we can pursue, like this interesting field. Well, what is rationality? So there's a lot of work to do out there, and it's interesting work, I think, at least for people who are interested in philosophy.
Right. Well, James, you know, in your book, you use the running of the bulls as an example for, you know, discussing distinction between dignity and pleasure. And I'm wondering if you can just sort of take us down that path to sort of give us an insight as to why you chose the running of the bulls and also how you think it plays out from the sense of dignity.
Sure. If I could, maybe I would start with on the subject of pleasure, because we've talked a little bit about dignity, and I've said that there are two kind of ways of talking about animal rights. There's the dignity route and the pleasure route. And the pleasure route is very interesting at the running of the bulls for the following reason, at least for the following reason. And it relates, by the way, to some time ago I was listening to your show and I heard Wayne Pacelli talking about don't quote me on this. He was talking about a Hollywood movie, and I believe it was a Noah's Ark. And it was curious because he said, well, look, the Hollywood producers had to go out and hire every single possible animal actor provider in Hollywood, because for the Noah's Ark movie they need every animal, right? And they found out in the interview, as I recall it, they decided they couldn't actually do that, and so they instead used animation techniques to create the animals, as Hollywood can do now. And so the point that was made there that in that interview is that this is a more humane alternative to the use of animals in the world in general. If we can replace animals with animations, it's better. That may be true, but I'm not so sure for the following reason. And that reason connects with the discussion of an interesting discussion about the bullfight, and it's the following. The bulls in Pamplona and in the bullfight generally, they have some of the most attractive and naturally satisfying lives that are available to any animal. They've received perfect veterinary care. They've received an abundant natural diet. They are allowed to run free on vast fields and Spanish estates. So their lives are, from almost any natural perspective, quite enviable until that one last day when there's abundant horror and death. And so the question in terms of pleasure ethics is the following. It is, well, if you had the choice to live an entire life of perfect abundance until one very bad day at the end, or your other choice is to not live at all, which would you choose? And that's the choice of Pamplona, for the bullfighting, because if the bullfight is eliminated, then these bulls will no longer be reared. So the choice for those bulls is either no existence or bountiful existence with a horrible end.
But they don't make the choice, though.
You're right, they don't. That's a terrific point, but things get very complicated here. That's actually a question on the level of dignity and freedom.
Yeah, it is.
For those who want to talk about pleasure ethics, which is different, what they want to say is we just evaluate everything in terms of happiness and sadness. And this is Peter Singer's approach. He says,
let's forget
about dignity, let's forget about freedom, let's forget about all that stuff, and just talk about happiness and sadness, or pleasure and pain. And what creates pleasure or minimizes pain is good, and the opposite is bad.
You know, James, it sounds like the kind of deal you make when you sell your soul to the devil. You have 10 years of a wonderful life until he takes your soul.
Right. Yeah, that's a perfect response, because this is exactly the question I ask in my class every semester. And I don't have a scientific survey, but it's curious. You know, when I ask the students, well, if you had the choice yourselves as a human to either not exist or exist abundantly until one very bad day, let's say Freddy Krueger or whatever horror you can imagine for a human horror for the last day, right? Which way would you go? And I find that people's responses is very instinctual. That is, they immediately go one way or the other. And it's about two-thirds, in my experience, not scientific, about two-thirds say, look, I would go for the great life with the horrible ending. And about one-third go for the prefer just not to exist.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that we like to think we would, prefer. But in reality, if you have a life of pleasure and abundance, you wind up as dumb as Donald Trump. But if, thinking back on my life, I would rather not have a life of complete pleasure all the time. My friends and family and companion animals who've died have been, some of the worst experiences of my life, and the girlfriends that have left me. But all those things made me a more complete person. That, if I'd have been laying on a couch with being fed grapes by beautiful women all my life, I wouldn't have any depth to me.
Yeah, I think that's also a terrific point. And this is something we sort of debate about on the philosophic side. We talk about a brain in a vat. That is, we ask people, if you had the opportunity to be only a brain and you were constantly fed pleasurable sensations of whatever kind, but you weren't actually doing anything out in the world, would you go for that or not? And that's a question that asks us, sort of as you're getting to, well, what counts as pleasure? I mean, is pleasure really just kind of hedonistic comfort? Or does pleasure include a real, true human pleasure and happiness? Does it include this kind of depth of experience?
Yeah, well, you have to have pain to be able to measure pleasure.
Right, right. And so then, so if you take that discussion, which is sometimes in philosophy, we call this the debate between the hedonists and the idealists. The hedonists go for just physical feeling, right? They want to go to the bar right now and so on. And the idealists want to go to the library and suffer while his girlfriend and so on. So if you take that debate, then you can bring that over to the question of the bulls in Pamplona and animals generally, right? And that which way you fall in this debate is going to change the way you think about animal rights. One way is going to lead you to say something that people might be uncomfortable with. They might say, look, I have to admit, even though I'm uncomfortable with it, that the bullfight in Pamplona is good because the actual result in terms of pleasure and pain is positive over the course of the entire life.
Yeah,
right, other people would disagree. But this gives us a way to talk about that in human terms, too. Which human experience is better? Is it the experience of comfort and grapes and the sofa? Or is it the experience that has more tribulations? I don't know. But it's interesting to have this back and forth on the level of animals and humans, it seems to me.
After reading your arguments on both sections, the pleasure versus the dignity, I think I tend to fall into the dignity argument because if we're weighing the pleasure of the bull's life, we're denying that animal its dignity. We're using that animal for our own means, and it's giving the best comfort to slaves, to putting them in a nice warm house and giving them food and things. We're using them, and that's why I think I tend to lead toward the dignity argument.
And that seems to be the more expansive route, right, James?
Right, it definitely is. And then in terms of, you mentioned earlier Tom Regan and Peter Singer. So Tom Regan goes the dignity route. And in my experience, I'm not going to impose views on others. I'm just saying, in my experience, many people who go the vegan route also are sympathetic with the dignity argument about animal rights.
The welfarist go the pleasure route.
That's right. So Wayne Pacelli is something more like, your guest, as I recall, something more like a welfarist.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, this is a debate. I remember also in that interview that you were debating with him about the difference between kind of going all the way and saying, look, we are not going to accept any kind of use of animals for any reason. I think that perhaps one of you was making that point. And he was saying, well, I'm more of an incrementalist. I just want to make things better little by little. That's an important question and a hard question to answer.
It's very hard because you got me thinking at one point about not using any animals at all. How do we animal activists feel about seeing eye dogs and other service animals? I think, in my case, I have to make an exception for the use of animals in such situations.
Right, yes. Taking this going the other way, we have similar problems in philosophy. For example, if you are going to be a hardcore dignity person, the problem you've brought up about seeing eye dogs and similar, we can ask the same thing about just our basic economic existence. Let's say that I own a 7-Eleven and I need to hire a cashier. Well, aren't I using this cashier as a kind of tool or as a means to my end? Seems like it's almost an abuse of the dignity of another human being to say, look, I'm hiring you essentially as a human robot, right, to take goods and ring up numbers and so on. So there is this debate on the human side, too. And we have to find a way to reconcile kind of our daily practices with our ideals. And one way we say this on the human side is that in some sense, that there is a dignity for a human being who's hired, even if it is a cashier, because he or she then perhaps receives a wage which allows he or she to pursue her destiny and so on. And perhaps there is a kind of dignity in being a CNI dog. Perhaps that there is a kind of fulfillment that the animal finds in this activity, and it's not simply being used as a tool or as a means to an end. And in that way, you could say that the animal is not, its dignity is not being abused, as opposed to the case of the bullfight in Pamplona, where it would appear that the dignity of the bull is being abused as it is stabbed and riled into aggressiveness and then finally killed for the spectator's enjoyment. So there are these ways to look at the difficult question of CNI dogs, for example, and there's the same problem exists on the human level when we talk about dignity. So that's sort of what's going on in the book. I'm trying to talk about how these issues recur on both the level of human and animals in ways that might be interesting for people who are interested in animal ethics.
And James, I think the important thing about, one of the important things about your work is that it does create a space where people actually examine, the role that animals play in their lives and, where they fall, whereas a lot of people sort of live blindly about going about their day and not thinking about the impact that it has on animals. And so at least encouraging people to take the time to figure out where they might fall on these philosophical issues is important for, helping us evolve as people. We're out of time here, but could you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about your work?
Of course. And thank you for those thoughts. And that's what I hope my contribution is to help people coming from all directions to think in interesting ways about these important issues. This work that we've discussed today is summarized, is captured in my recent and very short book, Dignity, Pleasures, Vulgarity, which is available at Amazon and in all its various formats and so on. And my own webpage is at jamesbrousseau, that's all one word, .net, and resources can be found there too.
We've been talking with Dr. James Brousseau, professor of philosophy at Pace University in New York and author of the new book, Dignity, Pleasures, Vulgarity. We thank you so much for your time today, James.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks, James.
If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org. And look at our calendar of events to find cooking classes, potlucks, and other events we have planned. On Saturday, May the 6th, we have our quarterly dinner with guest speaker J.L. Fields, who's the author of several vegan cookbooks. That will be at the Country Inn and Suites on Sunland Park Drive on May 6th at 6 p.m. To learn more about how to make reservations, please visit the calendar of events at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Greg Lawson. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to ACT Radio.